Good afternoon, everyone. I come to this subject from the point of view of a restitution lawyer. I'm not an expert in reparations more widely or human rights law, international law, but I've really become interested in the area through hearing about the litigation that took place in the United States that we've already heard something about, the slave descendants litigation, also the Holocaust litigation. So I come at it from that point of view. In both those sets of litigation, there was claims for restitution and or disgorgement on the basis of various torts such as conversion and also unjust enrichment. So that's really where I've come in at it, rather than sort of more generally those cases. Those are the specific aspects that I'm interested in. Starting with really just clarifying what I mean by restitution. This is a specific legal response which is different from the usual civil remedy that you would obtain, which would be compensation, and different because it focuses on the gain made by the defendant rather than compensation, which focuses on the loss suffered by the claimant. In English law, the main reasons that you would obtain a response for restitution is a successful claim in either unjust enrichment or for certain types of wrong. So it may be breach of contract, or it may be certain torts or equitable wrongdoing. But the principal cause of action that would found the claim in restitution is unjust enrichment, and that's principally what I'm going to consider today. It may be useful to a claimant to be able to have the opportunity to seek restitution, because it may not be possible to show that they have suffered a loss. In some cases, the claimant hasn't suffered a loss, or it may just be that they can't actually identify it very easily or prove it, but whereas they may be able to show that the defendant has certainly made a gain, they may have evidence to prove that the defendant's made a gain at their expense. So, specifically looking at unjust enrichment, it is not quite such a nebulous concept as it sounds. There has been some criticism of unjust enrichment generally over the years by people who, against its development, arguing that it's well-meaning sloppiness of thought and that kind of thing. But in actual fact, it is a very clear doctrine which is guided by legal precedent, just as negligence would be in the torts field. So what we are considering in terms of unjust enrichment, what the claimant must show, is firstly that the defendant was enriched. Secondly, that was at the claimant's expense. Thirdly, that the enrichment was unjust. And finally, that there are no applicable defences or bars. And the bars in particular can be an important issue in this context. So the slave litigation, or the slave descendants litigation in the United States that was previously referred to, and the lead plaintiff was Farmer Pellman, as we've heard, but there's a number of plaintiffs there who were all bringing class actions under US law. Unfortunately for those claimants, that litigation didn't get past the preliminary stage where the defendants were successful in bringing a motion to dismiss. So I think we've already heard this morning that one of the reasons for dismissing that those proceedings was the lack of standing of the claimants. There's also problems of the action being time-barred under the statutes of limitation that were relevant to the types of claim, and also the issue of the political question. So the court said this is something that should be dealt with by the executive part of the state apparatus rather than the judicial. So what the court never actually got to do, and similarly in terms of the Holocaust litigation because it settled pre-trial. What the court never got to do was actually look at the components of a claim in unjust enrichment or of a wrong such as tort of conversion and decide whether the required elements were established and whether therefore restitution should be granted. So that was what I really wanted to try and do, although from an English point of view rather than from a US law point of view, which is obviously what would have been applied if the motion to dismiss hadn't been successful, but I don't know enough about US law to be able to do that. So from an English law point of view, interesting first point, which I'd forgotten before I started this research, was that in actual fact that the problem that you would expect to be the main problem here is the limitation period. But in actual fact, in terms of claims for restitution or unjust enrichment, the Limitation Act 1980 doesn't specify a specific period of limitation. So whereas for torts and contract, for example, we'd be looking at 6 years, there's nothing specifically stated in the Act itself for restitution. So that obviously begs the question, does that therefore mean that there's no period of limitation at all, and so that initial bar would not become a significant issue? In one case, Nelson and Rye, Mr. Justice Laddie did seem to accept the basic proposition that if the Limitation Act didn't specify a specific period of limitation, then no such limitation period was applicable. That was in context of a breach of trust, a breach of fiduciary duty claim. However, in one of the key decisions in restitution, the Westdeutsche Landesbank Jahreszentral and Islington London Borough Council case, at first instance, Mr. Justice Hobhouse came to the conclusion that in actual fact a 6-year limitation period would be applicable by analogy with contract law. He came to this conclusion after doing some Pepper and Hart research, looking at the proposals that had preceded an earlier limitation statute from 1936, and decided that where the Act referred to simple contract, that could include quasi-contract, which takes into account most claims of restitution. This followed on from an earlier case, Reed at Clocks Estate, where the Court of Appeal had assumed that claims for money had and received would also be treated like contract claims. So again, a 6-year limitation period would be applicable. It has been challenged, this assumption has been challenged by academics. One academic, McLean, has written that there should be a general presumption that time should be postponed from running. As it is in cases of mistake or fraud, there should be a general postponement of time wherever it may result in the unjust retention of a benefit by the defendant. So I think, I mean, the point is that the courts have assumed that a 6-year period is applicable, but I think there is at least room for argument here, whereas in the US case, I think it was much more straightforward in that statute was very clear in terms of limitation periods. So I think there would at least be room for argument in litigation in an English case, which is good news at the beginning. Things are less easy as the case would progress, though. So the first substantive point in a claim for unjust enrichment is the defendant enriched? And this is usually quite uncomplicated because the enrichment is usually something very simple like money. So the paradigm case of unjust enrichment is often said to be the mistaken payment of money. So the classic bank error in your favour from Monopoly fame, where your bank accidentally gives you £100. Clearly, you have received £100, which you have no entitlement to. It's quite easy to see what your enrichment is there. There are obviously more difficult problems in this type of case, where were claiming or attempting to claim for historical restitution for the effects of slavery. Firstly, the question of who would the defendants be, let alone identifying and valuing the enrichment itself. So in the US slave descendants litigation, the defendants were various companies, as we've heard, some of them probably not such good defendants now because they included Lehman Brothers, probably not worth going after them at the moment. You can see that there are clear benefits in taking action against corporate bodies like this, because they clearly don't have the same necessary natural lifespan that the individuals who would have been involved in slave trading, slave owning, would obviously have. So it may be that some of the companies that are around today, particularly insurance companies, may have been incorporated and may have had direct or indirect participation in slave trading in the past, and that's certainly the allegations made in the US litigation. Clearly, there could be problems of piercing the corporate veil if companies have been subsumed into other companies, but it may be possible to use litigation against current day companies, at least to apply some sort of pressure. We heard this morning about how JP Morgan admitted their involvement or the involvement of some of their sort of predecessor companies and set up a scholarship program as a result. So that kind of pressure could be put on, even if strictly on legal terms you couldn't succeed in piercing the corporate veil in court and obtaining a court decision against a present day company. Clearly, many individuals and families in this country were involved in slave trading, slave owning, merchants of commodities that came back from the Americas. And people who are alive today, individuals, families who are alive today, will no doubt be benefiting from inherited wealth that did come from the slave trade. In terms of taking action against those people, I can't see that would be possible. Clearly, they don't have a legal personality. A family doesn't have a legal personality in the way that a company does. And I don't think it would be possible to try and establish any kind of proprietary claim so that you could follow the wealth itself rather than the person. So I think that's a bit of a non-starter. Alternative potential defendants, perhaps the UK government, on the basis that the country as a whole was enriched. We've heard about how cities such as Bristol were built largely on the profits of slave trading. And clearly, I think there's evidence to show, although it's disputed to what degree, but there's evidence to show that the Industrial Revolution was partly funded by the profits of slave trading. So perhaps the UK government would be a defendant on the basis that the country as a whole has been enriched by slave trading. Under the Crown Proceedings Act 1947, it has been possible to sue the Crown, i.e. the government rather than the Queen, so we wouldn't really have the problems that were encountered in the US in terms of sovereign immunity. So that's one hurdle overcome. Clearly, there might be difficulties in terms of public opinion, in that it's already been mentioned, but many taxpayers who would ultimately have to pay if the government was successfully sued may be descendants of slaves themselves. They may have been descended from families who were living in extreme poverty and exploited, even though they weren't slaves at the time that the slave trade was going on, and so on. So there could be difficulties there with public opinion, which obviously wouldn't necessarily impact directly on the court proceedings themselves, but I think it is important to get a general sort of momentum of public support and political support behind these kind of campaigns, or else they're probably quite unlikely to succeed, particularly where you're expecting the court to exercise any amount of discretion. There are other potential defenders, but I'll go on just to identifying and valuing the enrichment. Clearly, that in itself could be quite difficult and would require a lot of historical evidence, perhaps economic evidence, maybe forensic accountants, maybe evidence from experts who I haven't even contemplated. But obviously, it's been mentioned already this morning, the importance of evidence if you are trying to pursue a claim in the courts, and this is part of the problem with the slave descendants litigation in the US, was that the evidence just wasn't strong enough, I think. So the next question is, has the defendant, once we've hopefully identified someone, whether it be a company or the government or whoever, have they been enriched at the expense of the claimant? Now clearly, if a slave, him or herself, was able to sue, it would be clear that the slave trader had been enriched at their expense because they'd received money in payment for the slave being sold. The slave owner would have been enriched in that he'd received the value of free labour. Turning to the other types of defendant, though, such as the insurer or the bank and the private companies that might be sued, it's more difficult to see that they have clearly been enriched at the expense of the slave themselves. Directly, they've been enriched because they've entered into a contract with the person who owns the slave ship or whatever it may be. So it's only indirectly that they've been enriched by the at the expense of the slave, in that the ship would not be sailing, for example, so it wouldn't require insurance if it wasn't going on its business of slave trading. So even in terms of a claim, if it was made directly by a slave, which clearly it wouldn't be now, it's not particularly straightforward in respect of those defendants. The other problem here is that if there is an operative contract, so for example, an operative contract of insurance, that would bar any attempts to make a claim in unjust enrichment. The claimant would need to show that for some reason, for example, it's void or it's illegal or it's frustrated, that the contract is no longer operative. So it's not particularly straightforward in relation even to a claim made by the slaves, if they could. In terms of their descendants, even more difficult, because here you're trying to show that somehow the claimant, the defendant has profited at your expense when via a third party almost. And again, I think there are difficult issues there, which I can't really go into in detail because time's running out. But suffice to say, it would not be straightforward to show that. We also don't have the same type of class action in the UK that is available in the US, so I think that would make it more difficult to claim on sort of for a representative group. So to try and claim, for example, money on behalf of all descendants of slaves, so that the money could perhaps be put into a trust fund for education or something like that, I think that is going to be more difficult because of the lack of the class action like they have in the US. In terms of is the enrichment unjust, the way that English law deals with this traditionally is to ask whether one of a number of factors is present. So the one that I've mentioned in the example is mistake. So if the money was paid by mistake, that would count as an unjust factor, so that the money could be recovered. The one that stands out as being likely to be possible in this kind of claim is duress, so that the free labour was obtained by duress. Clearly we've heard about the extreme violence that was a routine part of slave trading, slave owning. Even that, though, would run into problems, I think, in English law, because what's required for duress is illegitimate threat or pressure. Whereas at the time, under English law, clearly slave trading, slave owning was legal until abolition in 1807. So I think there would even be difficulty in establishing that factor of duress. So that would even be for a claim made by a slave himself. I won't go into defences because I don't think it really arises too much. I think the principal problem would be limitation, which we've already dealt with. One of the interesting points of the US litigation was that a claim was made partly in conversion. So the argument ran that the slaves owned property in themselves, and that was then unlawfully interfered with and converted into money for the owners, which I think is quite incongruous when the principle is that people are not property, and yet the argument was that we own the property in ourselves, basically. So I think that's an interesting argument. Whether it could ever be successful in English law, I think I'm a little bit doubtful about, because presumably if something is property, it doesn't have standing to sue. So I'm trying to get my head around that one and work out whether it would ever be likely to succeed, and I think it probably wouldn't. So in conclusion, I'm reluctant to say that actually I don't think the law of restitution does come in as a white knight, really, and enable reparations to be claimed in English courts through this sort of means. I wish I could say otherwise. I wish I could say that it could, because I really like restitution and it would be great if it could provide a good solution and a remedy. But what it could perhaps do is, as happened in terms of the Holocaust litigation in America, is perhaps be a way of trying to exert some pressure, perhaps get people to the negotiating table. Possibly that could work. Maybe it would apply some moral and commercial pressure. The only caveat would be if there are adverse legal decisions, it can obviously weaken a negotiating position. And I think that's certainly the view of one of the counsel in the Holocaust litigation in terms of the German Foundation settlement, was that the settlement was, he estimated, about $5 to $10 million lower than what they thought they might have got, because there were a couple of adverse judicial decisions. So that's just a caveat, really. And also, just following on from what Esther was just saying just before me, about how actually money is really not even 1% of the point of this. In that sense, actually the claim for restitution would not be that useful, because it wouldn't... basically you are claiming for damages. It's just that they're restitutionary damages rather than compensatory damages. It wouldn't get you necessarily the apology, the acknowledgement, the taking of responsibility, and those kind of things. But perhaps that might come from the negotiating that might go alongside a claim in the courts.